The first one that I see come in the room was a darky dressed to death. He looked just like the playman that acted part Macbeth. He said he was from Africa, you know, and just arrived on shore. I asked him why he gave them raps so hard against the door.
Minstrel shows started around 1830, likely in New York City, featuring stereotypes of African-American culture. White entertainers painted their faces with burnt cork or shoe polish. They wore woolly wigs and donned raggy clothes. They took to the stage with performances that lampooned blacks as happy and hapless, ignorant and lazy.
It's not an easy story to tell, and it does involve all kinds of images and words and themes and tropes that are racist and offensive, but it is so important an element in our culture that it needs to be explored and discussed.
That's Stephen Railton, professor of English at the University of Virginia. He spent years studying the minstrel tradition, as has his colleague Eric Lott, who says Virginia was at the center of the movement, if in image only.
Virginia functions as largely kind of imaginary repository of fantasy about the South. And, you know, the number of songs about old Virginia is really interesting, since very few of those songs actually come from the state.
Carry Me Back to Old Virginia was, until recently, our state song. It was originally written for the minstrel stage by, in fact, an African-American composer named James Bland, who had never been in Virginia when he wrote the song.
And the Virginia Minstrels were one of the very first groups of blackface performers in the country. That group included a banjo player named Joel Walker Sweeney from Buckingham County. Vaughn Webb with the Blue Ridge Institute at Ferrum College points out Sweeney's down-picking clawhammer-style banjo marks the start of minstrelsy in Virginia.
There's a lot of discussion about how the banjo went from being an instrument of slavery, almost exclusively played by African Americans, to becoming the icon of white mountain music. It's quite a trip.
Sweeney gets much of the credit. Some say he was the first white man to perform on the banjo publicly. He did go on to become an international minstrel star. Musician and historian Bob Carlin wrote the book on Sweeney. He calls him the Elvis of the 1850s.
He definitely was a charismatic performer, as best we can tell from the hyperbole printed in the newspapers of the time, some of which may have been generated by himself. And he came up in a time period when America's culture was defining itself, moving away from being a replication of English and European culture and mixing and matching elements from Europe and Africa to become its own.
Here's an example of that sound, taking the melodies of European music, blending it with the rhythmical approach of African American music, combining it to make the first truly American musical form. Carlin has devoted extensive research to the topic, though he says most people, black and white, don't want to hear about it. He likens that attitude to throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
The bad of the period and of minstrelsy, so we don't want to deal with the good parts of it as well. And the good parts of it are, at least in that pre-war period, and in people like Joe Sweeney, who grew up with African Americans and was not a wealthy landholder by any means or a plantation owner, he grew up with those people and had lots of elements of their music in his music.
And the music continued to reflect the changing approach of blackface minstrelsy. After the Civil War, even black performers participated in minstrelsy, dancing and singing, performing in comic skits and variety acts. Some of the most popular songs in American history actually began as minstrel songs. Tunes like Dixie and Oh Susanna, Camp Town Races, and Old Folks at Home.
Way down upon the Swanee River, far, far away.
All were written by the most famous songwriter of the 19th century, Stephen Foster, whose later songs were free of racist ridicule.
All up and down the whole creation,
back at UVA, Professor Railton says minstrelsy was an attempt by whites to combat the abolitionist movement, suggesting through mockery that blacks just weren't up to the challenges of American citizenship.
That they're simple, that they don't understand the way white culture works, that they're very good at certain things like singing and dancing and living the life of the body. But when it comes to the higher cultural forms that would make you eligible for full citizenship, they're not equal. So to me, that continues to play out, that just as there is this pressure to see blacks as more equal, there is this pressure to find new ways to sort of keep them in a place that minstrelsy creates.
Oh, Sam was a gentleman, one of the oldest kind. His temper was very mild when he was let alone. But when you get him dander up, he spunk to the backbone. He wailed the sugar off you by double rule of three. And with his weight in wildcats when he got on a spree.
But social historian Eric Lott has some other, somewhat startling ideas that he published in his book, Love and Theft, Blackface Minstrelsy and the American Working Class.
I do think it has to do with wrestling with the blackface performance. It has to do with wrestling with the idea of African-American citizenship and full black subjectivity and consciousness and selfhood. I think the way that blackface performance negotiates those things, oddly enough, is through white men wanting to become black. Not just to produce jokes that will make fun of black people, but actually to become black.
She had a ticket engagement to go to the camp meeting with this child.
Ha! You went down to the fish market to dance all the reels. Mighty curious kind of camp meeting, that.
It wasn't eels, it was a big catfish.
What tune you dance? Oh!
Take your time, Miss Lucy, take your time, Miss Lucy, long. Oh, take your time, Miss Lucy, take your time, Miss Lucy, long.
Gentlemen, be seated. Well, Mr. Bones, how are you this evening?
Me? I'm the personification of health, Mr. Christie.
Good. Who was that lady I saw you with this afternoon?
That was no lady. That was my wife.
You know, at the same time as black people are being ridiculed and derided defensively, even necessarily, I think, for racist white men who are really threatened by the idea of black subjectivity, there's a real interest in seeing what it's like. There's a fascination with black people and black men in particular on the part of white men, which shades, in my view, if you look at the record, if you look at the documents, the songs, the illustrations, the engravings, some of the jokes, there's a real white male homosocial, sometimes even homoerotic investment in the black male body.
What do he say?
Whatever the impetus, both Railton and Lott believe the result placed public representation of black cultural forms in white hands. The two also agree that it's still evident in entertainment today. The topic was tackled in Spike Lee's film, Bamboozled.
I want a show that will make headlines.
One, two, three, two, one, come on!
The Huxtables, Cosby, a genius, revolutionary. But we can't go down that road again.
The network does not want to see Negroes on television unless they are buffoons.
It's a show within a movie about modern-day black actors in blackface, with an underlying simmering rage over media representations of African Americans.
The new Millennium Minstrel Show.
We're going to need a little more money for this.
This could be bigger than Friends, Ally McBeal, even my boys Amos and Andy.
Damn. You're putting white actors in blackface?
We're using black actors with blacker faces. Hollywood.
American minstrel theater actually continued into the 1960s. Billy Branson of Salem, who is black, remembers the minstrel performances of the Lions Club fondly. He and a group of friends made $100 a night performing in shows in a segregated high school auditorium for a white-only audience. They used the money to outfit their son's sports teams in 1964. They called themselves the Sons of Harmony.
We sang gospel, and that's all we did. But the people enjoyed it. Some of our race don't even like for you to sing. They're spirituals, you know, Negro spirituals, you know. But we still sing them.
And a configuration of that group still exists as the Harmonizing Crescendos.
There lived a man 1900 years ago. He laid down a baton just for you and me. And now he's gone away to prepare us a resting place. That's why you got to live like Jesus every day.
But back in the 1960s, at these Lions Club minstrel shows, Branson says two men, known as the End Men, sitting on each side of the stage, donned blackface makeup. They had stage names like Slim and Lockjaw, Happy and Filibuster. Branson insists while the shows weren't exactly family fair, they weren't mean-spirited either.
But everybody seemed to hate it because they stopped it, because it was crowded, it was overflowing each one of them three nights. We got encore after encore, you know, for the singing, so we enjoyed it. And then, too, it was helping us with the Sandlot program.
Vaughn Webb at the Blue Ridge Institute grew up in that era of minstrel variety acts.
I can remember going to see minstrel shows. I grew up in Waynesboro, up between Stanton and Charlottesville. I remember going to the minstrel show. In our collection here, we have a program from the minstrel show that P. Buckley Moss did the artwork for the program booklet. We have photos in our collection here at Ferrum of the Salem Minstrel Show. Town leaders in blackface on stage. So as the minstrel shows kind of became public variety shows, talent shows kind of in a way, you know, you'd highlight certain groups who already had a reputation in town for being talented in some musical area. And as integration progressed, African-American groups, too, join the stage.
Webb echoes Branson's remembrance of minstrel shows in the 1960s. It didn't seem mean-spirited at the time, he says.
Because it was part of the environment. It's difficult to say what we perceive of as hurtful now is not, you can use the phrase political correctness, but I believe in political correctness. And we are just, you know, good manners are being sensitive about other people's feelings. Even though there was still an enthusiastic audience for community minstrel shows, it became something that you just did not feel comfortable doing.
By 1970, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People had enough and wanted to see a permanent end to minstrel shows. Branson and his fellow singers say they were caught in the middle.
Yeah, I tried to explain to them. But, you know, they had their own feelings about it, you know. But it was fun, you know, just funny. And I just took it, I guess, the Christian way. They wasn't doing anything to offend the black race of people. They were doing things just to have fun. That's all. You know, it was fun, more fun than anything. They never said anything in there, you know, that would offend, even if they could go. It wasn't anything. They didn't say anything. We were just all buddies and we were friends.
At Virginia Tech's Department of Sociology, Professor Paula Marie Seniors more than understands the NAACP's disdain for those modern-day minstrel shows.
African Americans wanted to move so far away from their slave past. So spirituals, work songs were not something that people held on to. They were songs talking about actually gaining freedom, talking about insurgency, you know, fighting against slavery. And so they were revolutionary type songs. And so some in the African American community feel that, you know, it was an embarrassment that they did not want to remember this slave past.
Seniors is the author of the book Beyond Lift Every Voice and Sing, The Culture of Uplift, Identity, and Politics in Black Musical Theater. It focuses on the work of Lift Every Voice songwriters James Weldon Johnson and Bob Cole in their early 20th century musicals, Shoe Fly Regiment and The Red Moon.
And both of these musicals changed the representative image of African Americans. So they moved away from stereotypes. They actually put history on the stage. So Shoe Fly Regiment dealt with the black heroes of the Spanish-American War, dealt with the Tuskegee-like institution where black men and black women were being educated. The other musical, The Red Moon, put on stage the Hampton Native American African American educational program. In a sense, it was an industrial educational program. You brought Native Americans from the West to Hampton, Virginia to be educated.
For all of Johnson and Cole's work to elevate the cultural representation and social order of African Americans, Senior says there are still plenty of productions to knock it back down. Her examples of modern-day minstrelsy? Tyler Perry's Madea series, African American rappers who denigrate women and girls. She's even a little suspicious of the television show Glee and the portrayal of the one black female character on the program.
In one particular instance, she falls in love with the young gay man, which is an unrequited love. And so whereas the white female characters are having romantic relationships and having sparks and so on, this black girl is in effect playing a mammy character, asexual, mean, large.
But the roots of minstrelsy and the efforts to wipe the slate clean did have some positive impact, says Seniors.
Cole and Johnson, musicians are still talking about the music. People such as Fats Waller, Cecil and Blake, who wrote Shuffle Along, were part of this movement, talked about how special, how positive, how affirmative these musicals were during a time period when you did have these virulent stereotypes of African Americans, during a time period where you had extreme violence in the South.
But then, says musician Bob Carlin, consider the reaction to one present-day musical group, the Carolina Chocolate Drops.
A group of three young African-American musicians, albeit all with middle-class backgrounds, had to their record Genuine Negro Jig is the title of the album on Nonesuch. There's been some real negative reaction online to their using that term and that title, even though it is, they're just quoting a song title from that pre-Civil War minstrel era. They're really trying to reclaim their place at the musical table. They're really trying to reclaim something that African Americans have rejected for a long time.
Thank you. Again, here are UVA English professors Stephen Railton and Eric Lott.
As much as I, you know, wince at the story that this material forces you to think about, I am so grateful that the soundtrack of American culture had this cross-fertilization back in the 19th century and that it has continued through jazz and rock and roll. I think it's outrageous that Chuck Berry had one number one hit and Elvis had so many, and that the difference between them as musicians was simply racial.
Culturally, it's just crucial to ways of life, from the interactions between whites and African-American people to the foundations of early rock and roll. He used to carry his guitar
in a gunny sack, go sit beneath the tree by the river. Well, why don't you get a job and go to work?
Yo, Moose had me a job this morning.
Where?
I went down to the post office and asked that man, could he let me have one of them jobs as a letter toter?
No, Cotton, you mean a mail carrier.
And the man said, boy, if you give me a situation, he'd have to put me through a simple self-examination.
No, stupid. You mean a civil service examination.
Well, the man carried me in a little room and set me down and started asking me a gang of questions.
Well, what'd he ask you?
First thing the man asked me, say, how far is it from the sun to the moon?
He asked you how far it was from the sun to the moon?
Yeah, that's what the man asked me.
Well, what'd you tell him?
I told him if he was going to give me that route, I didn't want to jump.
Every immigrant group was stereotyped on the 19th century music hall stages. But for African Americans, this packaging and marketing of identity made a lasting impact. As for some white Americans who had little contact with black people by choice or by geography, blackface minstrel performance defined what it meant to be black.
Stop that knocking.
Let me in.
You had better stop that knocking at the door.
Let me in.
Stop that knocking.
Let me in.
Stop that knocking.
Let me in.
No one better
stop
that
knocking
at the door.
Stop that knocking, stop that knocking, stop that knocking, stop that knocking. You had better stop that knocking at the door.
Let me in.
Stop that knocking, stop that knocking, stop that knocking, stop that knocking.
You had better stop that knocking at the door.